I want to talk this time about the significance of the Euphrates River in Bible prophecy, and particularly the significance of the fact that the Islamic State, formerly known as ISIS, are now controlling the towns and cities along the River Euphrates, including the dams. Now, of course, the actual battle lines will sway backwards and forwards, and of course they may lose some dams and retake them. That's the nature of conflict. However, it does seem to me highly significant in view of what we read in Bible prophecy about this river. And I'd like to start off, though, by just clarifying something that's been commented on in my previous presentations, and it's this. I believe the Bible does require the development of an Islamic state in the land promised to Abraham. That is, from the river of Egypt, however you want to interpret that, the Nile or the brook, of Egypt right up to the River Euphrates. And that, of course, includes the land now inhabited by the Jews and known as Israel. But it's a pretty big territory. Now, I think the Bible prophecy requires an Islamic state. You can understand why I'm excited, therefore, that the Islamic State, an organization calling themselves the Islamic State, has declared its caliphate, its kingdom in that area. But it may not be them. It may not be ISIS or the IS or whatever as we now know them. What I'm talking about is an Islamic state that, it seems to me, is to be established. Now, the significance of the Euphrates is that it is the border of the land promised to Abraham, and that is made clear a number of times in the Bible itself. Now, when you read in the Hebrew Bible the word Eretz, you can either interpret this as meaning the whole planet, like the whole globe, or it has a specific meaning, not always, but very often it has the specific meaning of the land promised to Abraham. Now, when we're reading the Old Testament and the New Testament, you're reading God's word, and you're reading a piece of literature, if you like, although inspired by God, that focuses upon the land. And I suggest that all these things that we're reading in Revelation and so forth about the whole earth or whatever being dominated by the beast and wandering after the beast and so forth, that this is not necessarily talking about the entire planet. You know, Americans in the jungles of Amazonia, or folks in Africa or Asia or Australia even. This is talking about the land, the Eretz, that was promised to Abraham, that area from the Euphrates over to the river of Egypt, the Nile, or whatever, however you want to interpret that definition. And whenever Israel were judged by God, he threw them out of their land, and that meant that they had to go beyond the river Euphrates. They were taken over that river into captivity in Assyria, Babylon, etc. Rather like Adam, by the way, was thrown out of the Garden of Eden. And you know that one of the boundaries of the Garden of Eden, according to early Genesis, was the River Euphrates. I just mentioned that in passing. But what happened to Adam being thrown out of the garden was, in a sense, looking forward to Israel being thrown out of the same land, and then finally, through the work of the Lord Jesus and accepting it, being able finally to come back to paradise restored. Well, of course, you read in Revelation 9 and Revelation 16 about the drying up of the Euphrates in order to prepare the way of the kings of the east and to prepare the way to the final conflict called Armageddon. Now, of course, the waters of a river are symbolic in the Bible of nations, especially the Assyrians, the historical enemies of Israel described in Isaiah 8, Zechariah 10, Jeremiah 2, as the waters of a great river. So you can understand this in a metaphorical sense. And of course, the Assyrian armies are described in Isaiah 7:20 as the armies of those beyond the river, and the river is the Euphrates. Now, the picture then that you've got in Revelation 9 and 16 is of these hordes of people, the kings from the east, being restrained by this river, and then the four angels who hold the winds in their hand let them go, and then they rush to Armageddon. you can see, I think, why I'm sort of excited. Well, I am excited, not just sort of excited, but I think it is exciting and significant that now the towns along, and the cities along the River Euphrates are in the hands of a bunch of guys calling themselves the Islamic State, and who clearly are as vicious or more so than the Assyrians of old, and who clearly have a final agenda, which is to take the land of Israel and particularly Jerusalem. Now, in Daniel 8, you've got the same sort of metaphor where Greece is likened to a ram held back by a river. And there's angels in Daniel that stand on the waters of the rivers. So all this is sort of brought together in Revelation. That's what Revelation does. It picks up these images from prophecies like Daniel and develops them further in a latter-day context. Now, in Revelation 9:14, we're told that twice 10,000 times 10,000 horsemen were bound at the River Euphrates. Now, twice 10,000 times 10,000. When you come to Daniel chapter 7, you've got the fourth beast with its 10 horns, which equates with the image that Daniel saw in, or Nebuchadnezzar saw in chapter 2 with the 10 toes, talking about the latter day entity that will dominate the land of Israel. We've looked at that in the previous presentations. And then when that fourth beast with its 10 horns, etc., is destroyed, we read it's destroyed basically by the coming of Christ and the day of judgment, when 10,000 times 10,000 stand before him and are judged. Well, there in Revelation 9:14, you read about twice 10,000 times 10,000 coming from the east, bound by the River Euphrates, and then they're let go. They come and surge into the land promised to Abraham over the boundary of the Euphrates. So then those people, those hordes, according to Daniel 7, are the people who are going to be judged by the coming of Christ. And yet it's those hordes, this 10,000 times 10,000, this huge number, that are restrained for a while by the River Euphrates, and then the four angels let them go. Now, you can see, therefore, that those people, those hordes that are restrained, are therefore the ones who are going to actually come and meet Jesus Christ in judgment. Now, I've said that they were held back by the angels, and they are described in Revelation 9 as horsemen. Now, if you look at the ISIS or Islamic State promotional videos, and they're even on YouTube, you can access them quite easily, you find them loving to use the image of horsemen carrying their black jihad banners, which I suggested in the previous presentation, refer to the seal of Muhammad, the insignia of jihad, the mark, the insignia of the beast. Now, this restraint which has been put on these hordes by the River Euphrates, and it's suddenly taken away, what does this refer to? Well, I think it would be true to say that since Israel became a nation again in 1948, it has been a miracle how they have survived. Yeah, you can say, the Jews are smart, they had all the technology, blah, blah. But really, the whole thing was a miracle. And when you read the autobiographies of Jewish leaders, Israeli leaders over the past few decades, they all sort of come to this conclusion that, look, it was a miracle that we survived, that we got the nation of Israel to where it is, and that we've actually stayed there. And it is a miracle. I mean, they are surrounded by hordes of Muslim people who are bitterly opposed to them. How has it been that they have survived? And I don't agree with Christians glorifying the Israel Defense Force and talking about the bravery and the skill and the human strength of the Israeli military and leadership and so forth, because it's by God's restraining hand that they haven't been wiped out. It is by his grace. But those four angels that are restraining the hordes by the Euphrates, God let them go. There's another way that that works out. In terms of geopolitics, the power broker in that whole situation has been America and the West. That everybody knows that if the surrounding nations get too tough with Israel, well, America and the West are sort of going to fly in there and bail them out. Well, they never actually had to do that on the ground, but with huge logistical support, etc. Well, if the restraining power, the restraining influence is to be removed, that means that America and the West are not going to get involved anymore in holding these people off. That could arise from a number of different scenarios. It could be an energy embargo that's used. It could be simply a growth of radical Islam within the West itself. Or it could simply be, as we're already seeing, that America and the West are tired of endless conflict in the Middle East. And eventually some bright spark will come to the presidency and say, guys, I got a good idea. We're not getting involved out there any longer. And everyone will be like, yeah, that's a good idea. The guy next door and my cousin's son, they got killed out there. And what did we achieve? Nothing. You can just imagine those scenarios happening. It could be a whole load of different scenarios. It could be that the West collapses financially. Well, that's not at all unlikely. And then the whole thing is left totally impotent. There will be no restraining power. It doesn't matter. The four angels will see to this. They will take away this restraint, and then the hordes, the aggressive, revived Assyrian hordes that are there, these horsemen, as it were, on the banks of the Euphrates, will come over. Now, we read in Revelation 9 and 16 that the Euphrates will be dried up so that these kings from the east can go and invade. And in the Bible, when a river is dried up, it is in order that an army can pass over. You think of Jordan drying up and the conquest of Jericho. You think of the Red Sea drying up, etc. And so this is what's going to happen. And notice also that those four angels in Revelation 9 hold the winds in their hands. And you got the same angels in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and the Olivet prophecy, that the angels gather God's chosen people from the four winds. So again, this is all implying that this is leading up to the very last moments of human history as we know it. And then Christ will come back and the elect, the chosen, are gathered by those angels. So then you also got this weird thing in Daniel 12 where the angel stands on the river. And the river is not defined, but the river, when it's not defined in the Bible, in the Old Testament, is pretty well always the Euphrates. And the angel, from that perspective, pronounces that there will be a terrible time of trouble for Israel, such as has never been, and that includes what happened here in Europe in the Holocaust, for a time, times and a half, maybe 3.5 years. So then, it's surely no coincidence that there are, in fact, four nations located to the east of the Euphrates, Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and what I would call a de facto nation, Kurdistan. And I think you should look for Kurdistan becoming independent. And there's over 20 million of them there. It's about time they had, humanly speaking, it's about time they had their own state. And the entity known as Iraq is just a mistake. It's a line drawn on a map years ago by British colonial authorities, and it has no real meaning. Iraq has got to break up. It can't continue in the way that it has been. Another way to look at it is that Kurdistan will include the Kurdish areas of southern Turkey, and that's where the Euphrates is. And the Euphrates doesn't run right through Turkey. It starts in southern Turkey in the area now known as Turkish Kurdistan. So you could have Kurdistan, Syria, Iraq, plus the Islamic State. Maybe that is the fourth, I don't know. Let's be encouraged, though, that the sixth angel releases those hordes from behind the Euphrates because of a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God. It's in Revelation 9:30. But what's this golden altar before God? That figures earlier on in Revelation 8, verses 3 to 5, relating to the incense altar. What does that mean? Incense represents the prayers of the believers. That's what we're told. So it's because of our prayers for the second coming that when there's enough incense, as it were, on the altar, then the voice comes from the incense altar to the sixth angel, let the hordes go. So you wonder whether our prayers for the second coming are being heard. They are. Just that God doesn't rush, as it were. He has a perfect equilibrium in the way that he operates. So then all our prayers for the second coming, the incense going up, this has already, I think, been answered, because the word has gone to the sixth angel, release the hordes. Okay, let's get all these guys. These guys are crazed with hatred against Israel and a fanatic desire to take over the land promised to Abraham. Let's get them lined up on the banks of the Euphrates. That's where they are now. And let's let them go. So then, the drying up of the Euphrates could just be symbolic for an army crossing over, because that's why rivers are dried up in the Bible. But it also can be no accident that if actually these dams are in the hands of the Islamic State, or even some of them might be in the hands of the Kurds, but then if the Kurds make some agreement with the Islamic State, it's all the same, then actually the river could be dried up. And that's not just fiction, because Saddam Hussein actually did that when he was persecuting what are called the marsh Arabs. He actually turned off the water and dried up the marshes to force these guys out. They were one of the minorities, a pretty big minority, but one of the minorities that he persecuted. Of course, the Euphrates did literally dry up by human effort, so that Babylon would fall. That's how Babylon fell to the Darius the Mede, that he dried up the Euphrates and then came in and took Babylon. It may be that when we read in Revelation 16 about the drying up of the Euphrates, we as Bible students are supposed to think, what, you mean Babylon's about to fall? And of course, the fall of Babylon in Revelation is presented to us as happening when Jesus comes back. So don't think that water, the literal drying up of the water, is irrelevant. Because it has actually been observed on various media that actually water is going to play a crucial part in how the whole business with the Islamic State unravels. And of course, the historical king of Assyria, Sennacherib, he boasted, didn't he, when he came to attack Judah and Jerusalem. He said, I have digged and drunk strange waters, and with the sole of my feet I have dried up rivers. Yeah, he played around with this idea of drying up rivers and the Euphrates, etc. In Revelation 16:13, the drying up of the Euphrates leads to unclean spirits like frogs going out to deceive the nations and gather them to Armageddon. Unclean spirits. Well, a spirit can be a teaching. Try the spirits, 1 John 4:1. Try the spirits whether they're of God. So then this call, this ideology goes out as frogs who jump and, as it were, spread themselves further. This is the idea, this is the metaphor, that the frogs are going to jump and take this ideology to the nations surrounding Israel and gather them together once this happens. Now, I have never really come across any convincing interpretation of these unclean spirits like frogs. The popular one, of course, is, oh, it's liberty, equality, fraternity from the French Revolution, blah, blah, gathering the nations to Armageddon. Well, to be honest, that's intellectually desperate. It doesn't fit in any case. When you have a look at the whole Tigris-Euphrates basin there, it's very low-lying, and it's, as I've said, full of marshes. The marsh Arabs live in it. And you know what? It's full of frogs, not surprisingly. So I think the metaphor is based on the literal, as typically it is in the Bible, that, okay, the Euphrates is messed around with, and the Euphrates now has its lowest water flow of any time in recorded history, so don't think that this is wishful thinking, it's all on the way to fulfillment. And what's going to happen to the poor old frogs, like literally speaking, dry up the marshes, dry up the river to get the marsh adders out, like Saddam did? The frogs are going to have to jump further. And this is the literal basis for the metaphor. That the idea is that once this happens, then just as the frogs are going to have to leg it and spread themselves and go to new places, so the ideology will come out that gathers people to Armageddon. And already you can see that happening. Interviews of white Australian guys and British guys who've gone out there to fight for the Islamic State. This ideology is being spread all around the place. So then, the sixth trumpet in Revelation 9:14 and the sixth vial in Revelation 16:12 and 13, they both refer to the Euphrates drying up. So I think they're talking about the same event. Now, I know those of you who've been used to a continuous historical view of things will be slightly fazed by that. But I don't think you need to be, because it's Greek thinking and Latinate thinking that wants to see everything chronological, right? The first vial happens, the first trumpet happens. Oh, well, that must be at, let's say, 1900, and then the second vial happens, well, that must be 1910, or, you know, there's got to be this chronological progress. But that's not Hebrew thinking, and we're reading the Bible, that is, of course, God's book and is written from a Hebrew point of view. That's not at all required. When you've got those different vials, different trumpets, they're not necessarily chronological. They are snapshots of different angles on the same events. It's rather like looking through somebody's photo album, let's say, of their wedding or whatever, and there's the same guy, the same incident, the guy kissing the girl and so forth, taken from different angles, different perspectives. It's not all chronological. It's not, oh, well, first of all, this happened, and then the next photo, oh, yeah, that must be 5 minutes later. The next photo must be 5 minutes later. Not at all. It's just a mix-up of different pictures of the same reality. And I suggest that it's that obsession with this chronological fulfillment that has led to all sorts of pretty bizarre interpretations. For example, if these three frog-like spirits talk about a French Revolution, well, that was in 1789. That's a couple of hundred years or more ago now. Well, what happened after that? You know, it doesn't sort of quite fit in. So then the idea is that the hordes, which are now prepared and are standing there by the Euphrates River, will be released and will come into the Eretz, into the land that was promised to Abraham, that's bounded by the Euphrates River. And I'd like to read you from the Hadith. This is one of the interpretations of the Quran, and it's quite clear that the leadership of the current Islamic State are well versed in the Hadith and the Quran, and they are deeply religious people. I'll read it. The final battle will be waged by Muslim faithful coming on the backs of horses carrying black banners. Now that's Islamic State for you. They will stand on the east side of the Jordan River and will wage war that the land has never seen before. The black flags will come from the east. This is the kings of the east being brought in, according to Revelation. The black flags will come from the east, led by mighty men with long hair and beards. Well, that is exactly the picture of Revelation 9, verses 17 to 19, which I think is John back in the first century trying to use first century language to describe 21st century warfare. Here's what he says, that the hordes of horsemen who will be released upon the land from the Euphrates, they wore breastplates the colour of fire and of sapphire and of sulphur, The heads of the horses were like lions' heads. Fire, smoke, and sulfur came out of their mouths. By these three plagues, a third of mankind was killed, that is, on the earth, in the land, by the fire and smoke and sulfur coming out of their mouths. Now, this, as I say, is John in the first century trying to describe 21st century warfare, labouring, as Shakespeare would say, under the tyranny of words. For the power of the horses is in their mouths and in their tails, for their tails are like serpents with heads, and by means of them they wound. Well, the talk about killing a third of those that are in the land, I think has got to surely connect with Zechariah 13, verse 8, that says that when Jerusalem falls, two-thirds of the Jews will be killed. So one-third are killed by these guys, a third by another method, and then it would seem that another third eventually come through the fire and repent. Now, you've got this idea of rivers very often in the Bible. In Daniel 11, you've got the king of the north coming with horsemen, again, horsemen, which is imagery, symbology, metaphor, picked up by the current Islamic State, and entering into the land like a river that's overflowed its banks. Well, again, you've got this picture there in Revelation 16, using a slightly different metaphor, that the river dries up so that, not necessarily totally dries up, but dries up so that the army of the kings from the east can come through. The kings of the east. Well, in the presentation we did about black flags, and looking at all the hadith that talk about that, from black flags, it talks about from Khorasan, which seems to be Afghanistan. You can see the significance of Afghanistan, that's really been the birthplace of radical jihad, and when America unleashed its fury with Afghanistan, that's what really started it. And now these people are moving from there, and it's them that spawned, if you like, the Islamic State and these various jihadist organizations, and now they have got with them all these hordes of people that are now coming to them from all over the world. And the restraint that has been put on them at the Euphrates River, it seems to me, is now about to be lifted. And there they are lined up at the Euphrates River. Don't be fazed by, you know, the battle lines coming and swaying here and there and various alliances being made and failing and so forth. The general picture, when you look above, you know, the daily, hourly news, when you look at the general picture, absolutely clear. Now, what does that mean? Just interesting. Well, you know, in the Old Testament, there's a passage that says, why do you desire the day of the Lord? Because for what end will it be for you? In other words, yes, the day of the Lord will come. He that shall come will come. But are we ready? And this is the key issue, whether I'm right or whether I'm wrong in my suggestions about that day interpretation of the prophecy. That day shall come. We've got to be baptized into the Lord Jesus Christ and abide in him so that we may abide the day of his coming.